Okay, the next case is number 08-1106, Zhejiang Native Produce against the United States. Mr. Marshak.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is the second time we've appeared before this court in Civil Action 0257. In our October 16, 2006 oral argument, the Federal Circuit panel directed the majority of attention to the relationship between a 1995 suspension agreement between China and the United States, which established both quantitative restraints and a reference price on Chinese honey imports, and the Department's finding of less than fair value sales, its investigation, which ultimately led to a publication of a dumping order on honey from China. In its December 20th, 2005 decision on that appeal, this court held that the Department's finding of critical circumstances was not supported by substantial evidence, based on, and I'll quote, all factors, close quote, which it considered, the most notable factor being that, and again to directly quote the court's opinion, the Court of International Trade erred in holding that the suspension agreement was not designed to eliminate dumping. This court then remanded its decision to the CIT for appropriate further proceedings. The Department of Justice recognized the significance of that opinion on the relationship between the suspension agreement in the Department's less than fair value determination. And in a petition for rehearing, stated, contrary to the finding of the court, the suspension agreement was not required to, intended to, and in fact did not eliminate sales at less than fair value. The rehearing motion was denied. We agreed with the Department of Justice analysis of the impact of the Federal Circuit decision on the Department's finding of dumping. And thus, on October 27, 2006, we filed a 60B motion with the Court of International Trade, asking that court to implement your decision by finding a suspension agreement, in fact, eliminated dumping.
Mr. Marshak, could you address the finality question and our jurisdiction in this appeal?
Yes. If you're talking about finality, there are two issues of finality, I guess, in this case. The first issue was the fact that we did not directly appeal the first decision final in barring us from appeal, and we believe that it doesn't bar us because we have a clear change in controlling law. The second question of finality is whether we have the right, whether you have jurisdiction to hear this appeal at this particular time because there's still proceedings going on in the Court of International Trade.
Indeed, the Court of International Trade has stayed proceedings.
Yes, it has, Your Honor.
So if there's any doubt that there's something left at the Court of International Trade, that's belied by that ruling, is
yes,
it not?
Your Honor, there is something left at the Court of International Trade, but our position on this case, why we believe you have jurisdiction to hear this appeal at this time, is that the initial Court of International Trade decision was a final decision. And if that decision was final, our 60B motion against the final decision, the decision still remains final. We haven't been able to find any controlling, clear-cut judicial precedent on that particular issue. We admit there's something going on, but we believe it's not sufficient for you to not hear this case at this time.
Well, it just seems to me the Court of International Trade has before it the question of critical circumstances question. Once the Court of International Trade resolves that issue, then couldn't this whole matter come back to us and be heard at that time?
We believe if you decide today...
You're not going to lose this issue if we don't address it now, correct?
I would argue if you do not address this now... I would hope that you don't lose the issue. I mean, I would be very upset if the government didn't argue.
I'm sure you would. But
that we'd lose the issue, because then we'd lose it both ways.
But I don't see how that's the case. And the question that I'm struggling with is if that's the case, then why is this not sort of a piecemeal adjudication? Why is this not contrary to our normal rule of finality?
It probably would be contrary to your normal rule, but we believe there are exceptions to the normal rule of finality. In this case, you've decided to hear this appeal today, so it would be efficient to hear the appeal and issue the decision on the appeal today. And also, if we win this case here, we believe that the case, the other issue that's pending before the Court of National Trade, becomes moot. So as far as the efficiency of the process, and I think finality, one of the key factors there is efficiency, the most efficient way to deal with this, because you have decided to actually hear what we're saying today and to brief all the issues, would be for you to issue a decision at this time. If you don't issue a decision at this time, we'll be back.
Of course, that's true of a lot of interlocutory appeals. I mean, that it is, in a sense, more efficient if the court has allowed full briefing of the interlocutory appeal to chip off a piece of the case that then they don't have to deal with later. But that's generally not the approach we employ. And my concern, to follow up, if I may, on Judge Lynn's question, is if your theory is that a 60B motion, the premise of which is that the trial court on remand is departing in some respect from something that is either explicit or implicit in the remanding court's mandate or opinion, if that's enough to render the 60B motion proceeding final for purposes of an interlocutory appeal, couldn't that sort of process be followed in a very large number of remand cases? Because it's very frequently an issue before a trial court as to what the meaning of the Court of Appeals directives really should be when a case is remanded.
Your Honor, I can't argue with you on that. I'm sure that it could be followed in other cases. The fact is, we have a case here today, and rather than denying our motion by saying, we weren't appealing from a final decision, you decided for a full hearing on the merits of our motion and a full briefing on all the issues we have raised. So the fact of the matter is, we're here. And because we're here, I don't believe that you'd be doing any harm to the system if you'd listen to the appeal and issue a final decision on the appeal at this time.
Would you then say that one predicate, of course, for our deciding the merits would be that we'd have to say, well, we have jurisdiction. If we say we have jurisdiction in this case, how do we say to the next case, we don't have jurisdiction over you and therefore we're not going to have you fully brief the merits? It seems to me we've crossed that bridge once we've decided to hear the merits of this case.
The factors of this case, I believe, are unique. The factors of this case where we had a final decision by the Court of International Trade, and now we're filing a 60B against the final decision where we had a Court of Appellate Court, interceding Court of Appeals decision, is not something that comes up that often. So we've never filed a 60B motion against a CIT final decision. And it just doesn't happen that often in practical terms. So we believe we have something that doesn't occur that often, that's unique, and the fact that this court has decided to hear us, we believe, with the other factors, is sufficient to just go all the way and to issue a decision now. If you don't issue a decision now, we'll be back. The issue that you raised is probably the least important to us of the issues that we're arguing today, because if you don't hear us now, we would hope that you would issue an order saying you're going to hear us when we come back to you. We'd just delay the appeal, because this is it's a critical issue for us. It's a major issue in the case, and we believe it's absolutely necessary that this court make a final decision on the meaning of the suspension agreement. But we understand what you're saying, and we understand the issues.
Let's turn to the merits, and we'll take all of this under advisement.
Okay. As far as the merits of the case goes, we believe that the Court of International Trade abused its discretion. Your Honor, in Zijing 1, you issued a decision saying the Court of International Trade erred when it said the suspension agreement had no impact on dumping margins. And that was the holding. We believe it is the holding in the case. It was the analysis of the case. It was the most critical factor that you considered in the case.
But the only issue that was appealed in that case was the critical circumstances determination based on the application of the presumption, correct?
Yes, that was the only... Yes.
The underlying dumping determination was not appealed.
Your Honor, we admit that. We did not appeal that. and the government and the Court of International Trade and the government says we waive that. But
so now you're arguing that there was an intervening change in the law stemming from the very same case on an issue which you did not appeal. And that change in the law should apply in this very same proceeding.
Yes, Your Honor. Because
unusual is an understatement.
This is an unusual proceeding. This proceeding came up in a way that doesn't usually happen. Because the court, in the first Zhejiang case, spent the most part of its analysis and its opinion on this particular issue. The relationship between the suspension agreement and the ultimate finding of dumping. And that was the basis of the court's holding. That was, we believe, the critical factor that went to the court's final decision on critical circumstances. And because of that, you do have a change of law. You have a clear and controlling decision by the Court of Appeals of the Federal Circuit, and that becomes the law of the case or the law of the land. That's the law which the Court of International Trade is required to follow. The fact that we didn't appeal, we probably made a mistake. But that's not the end of it. Once this court issues a decision, the Court of International Trade, we believe, is required to follow the analysis in that decision. And this case is a prime example where the court, rather than international trade, on our 60B motion, rather than following the analysis of the decision, the court said that your decision wasn't serious. And they said they just looked at the pure holding of the case. But when you look at what Court of International Trade is supposed to do, when it has a Court of Appeals decision in front of it, what the court is required to do, it's supposed to look at the whole opinion. It has to look whether the issue was it fully considered by this court. And the relationship issue was clearly fully considered. Did the government participate? The government participated in this case. Was the court's analysis of the impact of the suspension agreement to the finding of dumping, was it necessary to the outcome of that case? And we believe it was. That was the key factor. The Court of Appeals last time, it took that issue up itself. It made a very informed decision that was a very, very critical issue in that case. And it created a legal principle as part of the relationship of a suspension agreement to a dumping finding, which the government was so concerned about that on rehearing, the government referred to that as the finding of the court. And that's why the government filed its petition for rehearing. And that's why we went out and filed a 60B motion. That case continued before the Court of International Trade. We don't have a situation here where, you know, where a case from a third party came up, where a decision of the Court of International Trade, where judgment had been executed. We have an ongoing case for the Court of International Trade, and what the Court of International Trade is required to do is to follow the principles set forth in the opinions of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. If they don't follow that principle in effect, they're not implementing your decision. Your decision says, in Zhejiang 1, that the Court of International Trade erred when it found that there was no relationship between the dumping determination, the suspension agreement, and sales at less than fair value. Now, that has become the law. And that is the law of this case, and that's the law which the Court of International Trade is required to implement. And it didn't do so. We understand there's a waiver principle, and the waiver principle is not sacrosanct. It's just a principle of law, but there's a clear exception to that principle when there's a change in control in law. And this court, in the COIL litigation, has accepted that principle. And we feel there's no real difference from what happened in the COIL litigation where there's a change in control in law, and the plaintiffs did not appeal a particular decision, but the court still considered that decision, and still CIT considered the decision, and the Federal Circuit considered that decision. Our case is much stronger.
The COIL case, we've had a lot of COIL cases. Do you remember which one it is?
I think three or four COIL cases, and we cite them in our brief, and for us to unravel them was complicated. But what happened was that in the first Timken case, there was a decision.
We've also had a lot of those.
Decision, you know, on a particular legal issue, I believe it was the cap issue, and the decision went against plaintiffs in that case, went against COIL in that case, and then there was an appeal to this court on all the issues, but COIL did not appeal, The court did not appeal the cap issue. But at the same time, there was an intervening decision by the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in another litigation. And that intervening decision came out after the first Federal Circuit opinion. So plaintiffs in that case went back to the lower court and they asked the lower court, look, consider this change in controlling law. And the court considered the change in controlling law. And we believe that's the law of this circuit. And it's a law that, and it makes a lot of sense. Because basically what we believe that's supposed to happen in cases is the court is supposed to apply the law. Here we're having a procedural, the question should is whether the procedural question that we fail to file an appeal should trump the clear holding and the clear analysis of this court.
Just to be clear, and perhaps your colleague has dug out the case, this is Coya at 95 F3rd, is that
the right? Your Honor, I don't remember the
your
site.
Your colleague actually is nodding, so I...
it's cited in our... This is cited in our...
Okay, I just cited
all
be,
the cases.
I just wanted to be sure I was on the same page. Okay,
but it gets, I guess, to the principle of what this court, what we believe that the purpose of the court is. The purpose of the Court of Appeals should be to issue decisions on what the law should be. And if the law says that you can't have dumping when you have a suspension agreement in effect, and if you have an ongoing case where you could apply that particular principle, and that's the substantive law of the land with a decision by the Court of Appeals or the Federal Circuit, we believe that the court should apply that decision to the facts of the case. And this case is the ongoing case of our litigation. Otherwise, basically our client is getting penalized because we didn't file, we failed to file an appeal of a particular issue. We may have failed to file it, but this court carefully considered the issue because it believed that issue was critical. And that has become the law which should be filed, and that has become the law which we believe should be implemented at the end of the day, rather than having the procedure trump. And there are cases in this circuit and in other circuits that there's this intermediate, this change in controlling law is really the critical factor that trumps the waiver doctrine.
In Coyle, it seems to me that was a different case in the sense that there was a very limited remand relating to simply ministerial actions, whereas here we have far more substantive issues.
Yes, that's on the jurisdictional issue, Your Honor. Yes, absolutely. Coyle comes up in 2 points here, on two issues. It comes up in the jurisdictional issue, and there, again, I'll concede that Coyle, was ongoing, but it was ministerial, and that's in the jurisdictional issue. But on, for us, what's really critical, the substantive issue, we think Coyle is controlling, and it shows what this court has done in this situation.
Yeah,
so there's the Coyle procedure and the Coyle substance.
Mr. Marashek, we're into your rebuttal time. Let's hear from the other side, and we'll save your time for rebuttal. Blades.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. Just to quickly, Judge Bryson, I believe it is the 95 Fed 3rd 1094 Coyle case.
Thanks.
This court should dismiss this matter, this appeal, as premature because the court lacks jurisdiction. Zhe Zhang is challenging a non-final decision of the trial court. The circumstances here isn't any different than any situation where the trial court may have decided some issue, remanded some other issue, and then the plaintiff decides it wants to take an appeal of the issue that's been decided. That's normally not allowed. There are, as the court is fully aware, appropriate procedures for doing things like that, such as 54B judgments, which was neither requested nor granted here, 28 U.S.C. 1292 interlocutory appeals, which also require a request to the trial court to certify the question, and then the permission of this court to appeal. That was not followed here. So there are alternative ways to get an issue that is an interlocutory issue before the court, none of which have the plaintiffs followed here. What we have here is simply an ongoing case where one of the issues has been decided by the trial court. The remaining issue, which happens to be the issue that was remanded by this court to the trial court has yet to be decided, and so the matter is not fully adjudicated. The trial court has not issued a final decision, and this court therefore lacks jurisdiction to consider this appeal. Further,
is there, as a practical matter, any prospect, depending on how the Court of International Trade decides the remaining issue in this case, is there any prospect that the decision on that issue will affect the issue that's being presented to us today? Or are they sufficiently independent that they would, that this issue will continue to be in the case regardless of how the court decides the other question?
The issues generally are not independent. They are interrelated in that they both flow from the implications of the suspension agreement upon the determination made by Commerce in this case. If we parse the issues enough, then perhaps they can be separated sufficiently that deciding one does not directly affect a certain aspect of deciding the other. I think that in and of itself is part of the problem that's presented by the procedural status of this case, and that is that
I probably wasn't clear. Where I'm really going with this is a much simpler and less abstract point, and that is Mr. Marshak says if we dismiss this appeal, he's saying we'll be back. Is that a given? Or, I mean, assuming that he continues to have an interest in the monetary effect of the ruling below, or is it possible that that would not necessarily happen based on further events in the trial court?
At the risk of placing myself in the position of representing his client, I would have to say that it may not happen that they would be back. That would, of course, be a decision that Zhejiang, with advice from counsel, would have to make. But as was explained in the brief, upon remand from this court, the Court of International Trade remanded further to the Department of Commerce. And upon remand, the Department of Commerce concluded that the record did not support a finding of critical circumstances. That is a ruling in favor of Zhejiang. That is a ruling that has been challenged by the domestic parties. If the Court of International Trade, in consideration of that remand determination, were to sustain Commerce's remand determination, that would be, as I said, in favor of Zhejiang.
Right.
And Zhejiang may be satisfied with that result. And Zhejiang may still want to come back to this court and say, we want even further relief. We want what they're asking for here.
But what I don't want to take up all your time with this because it's a collateral matter, I guess, potentially. But is there any prospect that the way that the Court of International Trade decides the question that's before it would affect the posture of the case, the issue that's before us today? Or does that issue remain, whether they are interested in taking it up or not, does that issue remain unaffected by the disposition of the other question? My instinct is to say it's unaffected, but
I think it is.
I want to make sure that's
right. I think it is arguably unaffected, and that's what I was about to say before. It's part of the problem with the procedural posture that this case, the procedural path that this case has taken, and that is that what Zhejiang is asking for now is something that, in full measure, has not yet been fully adjudicated before the trial court or placed fully before this court. They're asking the court to take a step to conclude that the suspension agreement necessarily eliminated any possibility of dumping. As a matter of fact, as a matter of law, there could not have possibly been any dumping during this period of investigation because the suspension agreement was in effect. That issue was not before the court last time. That issue is, in a way, before the court this time, but not having been fully adjudicated because it hasn't been addressed directly on the merits. It's been addressed in the context of a 60B motion for relief from that prior judgment. And so that places the court in the position of being asked by Zhejiang to make a very important decision on a matter that has not been fully ventilated from that perspective. And I think that's one of the reasons, among others, why the importance of applying the finality rule first for exercise of jurisdiction and then beyond that the mandate rule and the waiver rule, in that because Zhejiang did not appeal this particular issue previously, there should not be further litigation on that. There has been no change in the law in the sense of the example that plaintiffs used, the Corio case. There is not some other case that has said, okay, the law was one thing, but now this court or the Supreme Court has decided the law is something else. We simply have an appeal from one of two issues to this court. This court said on that one issue that was appealed, the trial court got it wrong. There was not, in fact, substantial evidence to support the critical circumstances finding.
But if we dismiss this appeal for lack of jurisdiction, and the case then goes back to the Court of International Trade, presumably the court will then act on the critical circumstances issue and resolve that issue. But with respect to the question before us today, the Court of International Trade is not going to do anything differently than it already has done, correct?
I presume that's correct, Your Honor.
So yes. The issue that is here today simply remains in the case and will remain unchanged, presumptively, until the next go-around.
Yeah, yes, sir. It would come up again if there is a further appeal from the Court of International Trade's final judgment.
Isn't Mr. Marshak correct then in saying that if you dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, we'll be back?
Well, as I explained before, that's the issue.
I think what he was saying was not, you know, our client is going to decide to appeal again. That's a separate question. But I think what he was trying to say was, if you dismiss it for lack of jurisdiction, the issue remains unchanged, and we'll come back and revisit you again with the same issue.
And if they were to appeal, yes, they would be back presumably with the same issue.
So dismissing it is certainly does not foster judicial efficiency if we may be faced with the same issue again on another go around.
Well, except that in that situation, from that perspective, it is not any different than many interlocutory decisions that could be placed before this court and often are not. I mean, for example, it is not unusual for a trial court to reject a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. Now, if the defendant in that case were correct and that matter were appealed to this court through whatever interlocutory channel would be appropriate, and this court were to reverse and say, no, the defendant is correct, the trial court does not have jurisdiction, that would be very economical and would be very efficient. But that is not the normal way that things work. And I'm not saying that just because the normal way is the normal way, it
Except
should be followed.
In that very case, if the defendant wins on the merits, then presumably that issue may never come to us.
It may not, but...
This is a case in which we will see the issue again, at least it seems apparent that we will.
Well, if there's a further appeal, and even in that example, I mean, I can call the court's attention to a much older case, the Sharman case, where the United States said the trial court did not have jurisdiction over the matter. The trial court said, yes, it did. The United States filed a counterclaim. The United States won on its counterclaim. Nevertheless, the matter was appealed, I guess because we won and then the plaintiffs lost. And on appeal, the United States said, again, you know we won, but the trial court didn't have any jurisdiction. And this court ultimately said, that's correct. The trial court didn't have jurisdiction. And jurisdiction, as the court is fully aware, is a critical fundamental matter. And it's not something that is rejected just as a matter of efficiency.
And you're saying this case is no different than any number of other cases involving an interlocutory issue?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But you're also saying that there's no way that the decision of the state case in the Court of International Trade could be decided in a manner whereby sufficient relief would be provided to Zhejiang so that they wouldn't be back.
Will they get all of the relief they're asking for here? Unlikely. Yes, I mean, to that extent.
Unless Judge Tsoukalos changes his mind.
Judge Eaton, I think it is. But,
oh, is yes. it? I thought it was Judge Tsoukalos.
Anyway. Right.
Well, in that case, it doesn't matter whether Judge Tsoukalos changes his mind.
Well, we're running very short of time. Would you care to comment on the merits of the appeal?
Yes, ma'am. As has been pointed out, what this court decided in its first appeal was that there was not sufficient evidence, substantial evidence, to support the conclusion that knowledge of dumping could be imputed so as to find critical circumstances. This court did not find, despite the language relied upon by Zhejiang to take it a step further and say there couldn't possibly have been any dumping, this court didn't even find that there could not possibly have been critical circumstances. The court found that in the context of an investigation that overlapped with the suspension agreement, that the commerce's normal practice of imputing knowledge of dumping based on margins in excess of 25% was not something that could be supported by substantial evidence, and remanded back. The court did not remand back with instructions to find no critical circumstances. The court did not say there could not possibly be critical circumstances. If the court did not even go that far, the court certainly did not intend to go as far as Zhejiang asks it to go today and reach the conclusion that there could not possibly have been any dumping. And it is necessarily appropriate, as the trial court did, to read this court's prior decision in the context of the single issue that was appealed, and that was the issue of critical circumstances. The trial court correctly remanded back to Commerce to reconsider the issue of critical circumstances, and as we have discussed, that issue is still pending before the trial court. This court's prior decision did not go as far as Zhejiang asked the court to read it today. And with that, we respectfully ask the court to either dismiss for lack of jurisdiction or to, in the alternative, affirm the trial court's denial of Zhejiang's Rule 60B motion.
Let me ask you just a quick question about the suspension agreement. Did the suspension agreement restrict in any way the volume of imports into the United States?
Yes, sir. I
know it addressed price and pricing issues, but did it also restrict volume?
Yes, it did. I don't know off the top of my head which provision of the suspension agreement actually restricted volume, but it did. It restricted volume, and it pegged the reference prices to other imports.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Corsi, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mike Corsi for Defendant Appellees, Sioux Honey Association and American Honey Producers Association. I would like to make just four quick points on the merits. We support the government on the jurisdictional issues or the timing issues. In terms of my points on the substance, I would invite the court to review the decision, which I believe, in my reading, demonstrates that the phrase that the Zhejiang has taken out of context is not part of the holding. Have to keep in mind, this is a critical circumstance examination. This court, I believe, has only examined one other critical case involving critical circumstances. That was the ICC case 17 years ago. In that case, cited in the decision, you started in your analysis, once you get through the beginning parts, was saying, Commerce itself has said, and we have held in ICI, that critical circumstances decisions are to be made on the facts, on an examination of the facts and circumstances. The statute doesn't give great guidance. What concerned the court here was the fact that Commerce did not examine any facts. Commerce said, for purposes of the knowledge of dumping test, that dumping margins above 25%, no further analysis, knowledge of dumping exists. If you look at your holding, the fourth sentence at the end, it, even where there is a discussion of the suspension agreement, the emphasis is on the suspension agreement prices that were supposed to prevent injury. There's nothing about dumping there. So what the court was concerned about was Commerce did not engage in a factual analysis. It did so in ICI, and this court upheld it in ICI, and the court said, in that case, that this is what Commerce is supposed to do. Look at the facts of each case. So, therefore, our view is that it's the phrase is not within the whole the holding of the case. There's no new law, even if we got to that point. Pollo Seco is a completely different case, and I would submit, Your Honor, that the two differences are the intervening law in Coyo was outside of the case. Two instances, the GATT law and another case that this court looked at altogether. The Coyo case where the issue had not been appealed was itself, other aspects were appealed to this court. The remand was very broad. Look at all dumping, the whole dumping calculation. That's very different from the remand in this case where the analysis, the remand instruction was on the issue of critical circumstances. It wasn't broad, as the government has said here. Third point, the exception, or the mandate rule exception, I think that's maybe gotten lost here. We have to look at what you have held in the past. An exception to the mandate rule has to be exceptional. The appellants went under Rule 60B. They cite Moore principally in the principal brief as their support. Well, when you read Moore, Moore says 60B basically applies to excusable neglect. You could never have excusable neglect when there is a deliberate, knowing, intentional decision not to appeal. That's what they made. They could have appealed. They didn't do it. There's no basis for them to be before this court. Finally, on timing, I heard JJ's counsel say that they had read the government's brief asking for a rehearing, and that alerted them to coming and filing their motion. They didn't file their motion until 8 months after your mandate came down. It was 4 months after the CIT issued its remand instructions to Commerce, and 2 months or 6 weeks after Commerce sent its remand instructions back. If there was such a great similarity in these issues, why wasn't the plaintiffs, the appellant, into the court, the CIT, earlier than 8 months after the mandate? Thank you. I'll stop with that.
Thank you, Mr. Corsi. Mr. Marshak, 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the jurisdictional issue, just one point. This is the critical issue in the case, the issue right here. The issue on critical circumstances really is a secondary issue. If we win this issue, the dumping order, we believe, goes away and the critical circumstances isn't heard. As far as the merits of the case, I heard the government say that this issue was not fully ventilated when we were here before, and we believe that it absolutely was fully ventilated. If you look at the oral court, if you were here at oral argument, read the transcript of oral argument, and look at the court's opinion, we believe the court's opinion speaks for itself. The court expressly said on, I think, four specific occasions with a complete analysis that took up half the court's opinion that the statute does not mean or imply that dumping prices are intended to be acceptable. The statute itself mandates that, and I quote, prices of compliance with the suspension agreement were required to be at a level that would eliminate sales at less than fair value. Now, these are pure issues of law. This is statutory construction and the construction of the agreement, which is not getting to the facts of critical circumstances. And when you look at the court's, you look at the holding of the court, the court says when all factors are considered, there is not substantial evidence. Well, one of the key factors that the court considered was the relationship of the suspension agreement to the finding of sales of less than fair value, a pure issue of law. So we submit that it really was part of the holding of the court in Zhejiang 1, this relationship with the agreement and sales of less than fair value. The government and Mr. Corsi also talk about the scope of the remand. The remand in this case, the scope of the court's decision in this case, and the instructions it gave the Court of International Trade. What the court said, it says, contrary to the ruling of the Court of International The contrary ruling of the Court of International Trade is reversed. So the contrary ruling on critical circumstances and also the contrary ruling on the relationship of the agreement to dumping. And then this court said, this case is remanded for appropriate further proceedings. Appropriate further proceedings. There's nothing in those words limiting the Court of International Trade's analysis. So what we read the Zhejiang opinion, the government filed a petition for rehearing. They didn't file for cert. And then we did our own research, and we went, we believe, It took several months, but as quickly as we could, doing and analyzing the issues, researching the issues, and making sure we didn't file a frivolous appeal. We wanted to make sure we were on sound ground when we filed a 60B motion. We don't do that often. In fact, we've never done it before. So we took the time, and we don't think there was any prejudice to the government or any prejudice to petitioners. Our 60B motion was filed when the case was an ongoing case. So it wasn't as if the case ended and we filed later where there was an executed judgment. This case was continuing. So there was no prejudice at all when we filed the 60B motion. The other thing, we weren't form shopping, and we're in no better position now than we would have been before. In fact, we're in a worse position because we have jurisdictional issues. This wasn't something that we did for any grand strategy to get us in a better place. We didn't file something, but this court issued a decision on the merits on a substantive issue, and we believe that the law in this circuit should be the law that this court, that the construction of law, when this court resolves and considers a pure issue of law, which is a relationship and a suspension agreement to a finding of dumping. That's the law of this circuit, that's the law of this land, and we don't believe there is any reason why that law shouldn't be followed by the Court of International Trade. In fact, we believe we're in a better position than were the plaintiffs in COIL. The plaintiffs, it's really the same. They also did not appeal a particular issue that they had the right to appeal. They did not appeal. And in COIL, there was an intervening decision by another federal circuit court that came into the case. In our case, the intervening decision was the opinion of this court, where this court took up the issue itself because it was so critical to the court's understanding of what was going on. So this court made a very informed decision. And all we're really asking is that the court's decision be followed and the court's decision be implemented by the Court of International Trade. And that's what law is all about. You have an appellate court issuing decision, a pure issue of law, and that decision should become the law of the case and the law of the land and a law that should be followed by the Court of International Trade in subsequent proceedings when there is really no reason not to. There's no finality and there's no prejudice, and this is the law which we believe this court should follow. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marshak, Mr. Blades, Mr. Corsi. Case is taken under submission.
Thank you.